This is ESPN 103.7 Lafayette and 104.1 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station. This is 2 hours of sports talk like none other. Footnotes with the man who speaks his own language.
Me fail English? That's impossible.
Your host, Kevin Foote.
Welcome into Footnotes. You are listening to ESPN 103.7 Lafayette, 104.1 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana Sports Station, broadcasting live from the EFCO Development Studios in Upper Lafayette. And give us a call on the Mike's Marine Hotline, 337-706-0111, brought to you by Mike's Marine, keeping you on the water. We've been doing a lot of interviews, haven't had as much time to take phone calls on the hotline. We will today, other than we are talking NFL draft with Luke Johnson in about a half hour, a little over a half hour. So really looking forward to seeing what Luke thinks and what he's guessing. And again, we're all guessing and speculating. We get this. And so much of what you're hearing recently, you just wonder what any of it means. And some of it just doesn't seem to make any sense whatsoever. It's like, where is this coming from? And we'll talk about all of those things. All right. I did not get to see the NBA games last night because I was covering baseball and softball. Everything I saw was that the Heat-Sixers game was terrible, but the Heat pulled it out. I mean, the Sixers pulled it out by a point, and the Bulls crushed the Hawks. But
what do you mean by terrible? I thought it was an outstandingly entertaining game.
I don't know. All the highlights and the analysis was like, man, Embiid did not look good. He looked slow, and he hit shots, but he didn't move on defense. He didn't do this. He didn't do that. And Butler got hurt. It was a close game, but it was like it was basically
well. So,
I mean, I think what we were thinking was going to come out of this game was that either the Heat maybe could be the Heat, like I was talking about yesterday, which now no one thinks that anymore, especially with Butler hurt, and that Embiid looks so bad that, well, they're not really a threat either.
Yeah, I mean, I would say give Embiid some time a little bit here, but I want to ask a question. I don't have enough data. I haven't done the research to back it up, but I will ask the question. Are we getting a little concerned that the NBA has reached a point where we know that the playoffs are a different thing? We're getting a lot of players getting hurt when it gets to playoff time. And I would you'd have to go back and take a look at injuries per game and stuff like that. But just in these play-in games, and maybe it's just because it's high-profile players. Zion goes down, he's going to be out at least 2 weeks. Jimmy Butler goes down, he's going to be out at least 3 weeks. Remember last year, Tyler Hero went out in the first game of the playoffs and missed the entire playoffs. I just wonder, at some point, since we know that it's a different level in the NBA playoffs, if all of that, and all of a sudden you ramp it up to 100 in these games, does that have an impact? I don't have enough data in front of me to actually say it. I just wanted to ask the question.
It's certainly worth considering, but I still don't get, what did Zion do?
I mean, he pulled his hamstring, I guess. That's all I could tell you. I mean, he's got a hamstring injury. I mean, I guess he pulled his hamstring. And I guess, again, they're still playing a physical game at a high level, regardless of whether it's playoff intensity or not. So maybe it's just a silly coincidence, but it's really weird to me that in these, you know, four isolated games, we've had superstars get hurt in half of them for half the teams.
But what's the solution or even...
No, I don't... Well, again, I think there's an argument to be had that in the days of the, you know, late 90s and into the early 2000s and all the way into the 2010s, that guys played with that level of intensity or close to it for most of the season. And so their bodies were more conditioned to it. Again, I am completely theorizing here. I'm not creating a scientific argument with data to back it up. But I thought that was unfortunate because now both those teams ended up losing their games. Both those teams are still in it, but now don't have their best player. And if they do win it and make it to the, which I think we think that they're the better team. I think we think the Pelicans are better than the Kings. I think we think the Heat are better than the Bulls. But even if they win, they're now going to be handicapped in their first.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, or held back, I should say. Better choice of terminology there. They're not going to be their full potential in the first round series. So, also, by the way, we talk a lot about one seeds getting a reward. In these two situations, the one seeds in each conference are now going to be facing teams that aren't as good. So I guess in some ways, the play-in tournament did help the one seeds, but not by design exactly.
Which is where I was going next. A very sickening, and really it's not, because I don't really have anything against this team other than Paul lumping them with the Yankees so much. Really now... I have no choice but to go all in on the Knicks. I mean, because they're the only team. Like the Bucks aren't doing anything, and you know that. You know, if you listen to all the, I mean, I heard several analysts this morning. They're like, Embiid is just, he can't do this and he can't do that, and he's playing on one leg and this and all. And it's like, the only thing that can keep the Celtics from making the finals is the Knicks, just because everyone else is just injured or just not good or just total shambles like the Bucks are. And that's an injury situation too. So, like, I mean, it's just like everyone in the Eastern Conference dropping like flies, and it is I'm forced now, because I really don't have anything against the Knicks. I mean, they won their titles before I really I started being a Laker fan like a year or two after. I don't know if it was a year or 2 years after the Knicks, the big famous Knicks, their last title. I don't think I really followed the NBA that year. I think it was the year after or the year after that I followed them. So since I've been an NBA fan, the Knicks have never been anything. I mean, I've never cared about them. I always thought Knickerbockers was a cool nickname. Never had anything against the Knicks. They were never a factor. I mean, you know, the whole time that I was a big NBA fan in the 70s and 80s, the Knicks were nothing. And so I don't really have anything against the Knicks, but now I have no choice but to go all in on the Knicks. I know you're down on them, but is it even possible?
Well, why the Knicks?
Who else can beat the Celtics? Like everyone else is terrible.
Okay, you're talking about just the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, we're just talking about stopping the Celtics.
I was going to say the Thunder are way more fun up and coming story than the Knicks.
No, no, no. I'm talking about keeping the Celtics out of the finals.
I mean, yeah, I think you're fighting a losing battle.
I mean, everyone else is just dropping like flies. I mean, it's just like, why did they even make them play a game? Just let them go. It's crazy.
I mean, Giannis is going to give it a go, right? He's going to be out, what, the first few
They're hoping
games?
To be back later in the series is what the last thing I heard.
I still think your best chance of somebody beating the Celtics would be the Bucks. But the no, Bucks? Your best actual chance of the Celtics not making it is their... their flaws being real, their playoff woes, and
yeah,
the
but
moment
against
being,
who? Somebody still got to expose those flaws.
Well, last year it was a Heat team that wasn't, you know, great, and they figured it out the right time. So I guess your best bet is a story like that. So who can you find? I don't think the Knicks have Heat like qualities from last year. Who's that team that's lingering down there? That's you know,
the Pacers.
Man, I mean, again, do they have any of those types of... is there a Jimmy Butler-type player on any of these rosters? The Bulls, do they have
no.
with DeRozan? With what? I mean, the Bulls looked last night as... I think that was peak form Bulls teams. But again, yeah, I don't think they're going to shoot like that four times in a seven-game series against anybody.
I don't think the Sixers... I don't even think... they don't match up with the Knicks, especially with Embiid if he's really on one leg. And playing as poorly as he apparently looked. Everybody talked about how terrible he looked last night.
It's not that this is a doom and gloom first segment. We haven't even gotten to the Astros, so yikes, man, what a day we got ahead of us. For the Pelicans, and I've seen this, you know, and look, the Pelicans reporters and all the guys who cover the team, all the guys and girls, they're reporting what they're reporting, the facts of what was said. But when they say Zion's going to be reevaluated in 2 weeks, a lot of everyone's been saying if they were to do that, that would be game five of the first round series if they got there, was when he'd be reevaluated. Let's remember, the Pelicans, we know how this works, especially with Zion. When have they ever reevaluated a player in 2 weeks and then said, oh, he's good to go that day? There's no chance Zion would play in a first round series, because there's no, even if they reevaluate him in 2 weeks and they say all's good, they're going to give you that, well, we're going to ramp him up to basketball activities thing, and he's not going to play another week after that. So you're looking at the Pelicans are not going to have Zion in a first round series at all. And I kept seeing that, well, maybe game five. No, they're not going to reevaluate him,
but
and go, yeah, he's playing.
Have, look, I understand. Don't they have, now again, the problem for me is not, I mean, obviously you want Zion playing, but the problem is you don't have Ingram either really right now.
Yeah, and I do. There's a little,
because you can play different without Zion if Ingram is Ingram, and I think still win the series.
And again, you got to win tomorrow before that matters. But no, I do agree, and I have more hope that Ingram can be Ingram by game four, game five. And look, if you steal one before then, and you're down 2-1, but you get Ingram looking like Ingram in game four, five, yeah, I think you'd have a remote chance. Especially again, you'd feel better about doing that against OKC than you would, but they haven't matched up well with the Thunder with everybody healthy, and they're not going to match up well with them without guys out. And so I just, again, that's even if you beat Sacramento tomorrow, which I think is far from a guarantee. You got to also think about the level of morale in that locker room right now. With Zion going out and B.I. not being himself and C.J. having another awful game in a big-time moment, I wonder where that morale of that locker room is going into a game against Sacramento, who's, again, feeling like, hey, we just took out the, you know, we just ended the long-running last run at a dynasty that Golden State was trying to put together, and we got nothing to lose going to New Orleans.
I really think that Golden State game was bigger than you think it was. In the perception, I know it didn't end up being that big, but I'm talking about in the perception of the players. Because I watched, like, a lot of that game, and at the end, they were celebrating. Joe Myers and them were acting like it was done. They were the 6-seed. Now, I know they weren't. But
yeah,
they had that mentality about that game.
The other thing that I do think is unfortunate about it, and we're going to see it, we'll see. If this, let's say the Pelicans win tomorrow and they get to this series, and you hope they steal a game or two along the way where game five and game six would be happening. My issue with the Zion situation is, what are you saving him for? Like, what is the, so it's this long term, you know, and I bought into it in week two of the season when people were losing their minds that he sat out the fourth game of the year on a back to back. I was like, okay, guys, let's think about what matters here, and that's the playoffs. But it's the same type of logic of like a pitcher, let's say, who's a journeyman pitcher who's trying to throw a no hitter or something like that, and then they pull him because of pitch count. It's like, what are we saving him for? And so if Zion does come back to the spot where they're like, yeah, he's progressing well, but we want to hold him out, what are you saving him for if they don't let him come back? And I'm forward thinking here, but that's what would frustrate me. Like, he's been in the year. It's not like he's 19 anymore and we're saving himself from himself. And if you're a Pelicans organization specifically, what are you doing? Saving him for the next team he plays for? Like, after you leave because you don't win anything? So I will be really interested to see how they handle the whole Zion gets reevaluated, and that's all if it even matters, if they're even still playing basketball at that point.
Very good points. All right, Cajun baseball won big last night. Softball had a slow start, but won big. We'll be talking more tomorrow and maybe in the 10 o'clock hour. Cajun's big game, big series starts tomorrow at Coastal Carolina, and we'll see how the pitching has been fabulous. Again, the pitching challenge is going to be totally different at Coastal than what it's been. And so, you know, the standards for what is a well-pitched game, I think, are going to be different. And so it'll be interesting to see. I think it was great that the offense is going in with some momentum after these two games against Southeastern. I still wish this team would get a little more proficient at small ball, because it's something they do a lot and something they depend on, and they still mess it up way too often for me. But there's a lot of lot of good vibes there, and so we'll talk more about that when we come back after this first timeout. he mentioned the Astros. Yesterday was so frustrating. So we'll talk about that. And I also, I'll give you my three biggest concerns. I know it's April, but my three biggest long-term concerns about the Astros during this early season debacle that we're living through right now. We'll do that, and we'll be back.
Go sign up for our Rewards Club at ESPNSouthwestLouisiana.com so you can score tickets, gift certificates, and much more. This is ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
Welcome back to Footnotes. You are listening to ESPN 1037 Lafayette, 1041 Lake Charles. You can give us a call on the Mike's Marine Hotline, 337-706-0111. All right. Three biggest concerns right now about the Astros. And really, it's one, and then there is a huge gap after that. And then there's another huge gap between the third one. I think the absolute number one biggest concern right now, and again, there are a lot of things that aren't going well. Nothing's going well. But the number one biggest concern, besides health, when you obviously health is the number one for everyone. Like, if you get all your best players hurt, nothing else matters. So health is an understood, always biggest concern. But I'm talking about players. The number one concern right now, and number two or three or four is not even close to me, is Ryan Pressly. Well, first of all, Ryan Pressly is going to go down probably one of my top five or six favorite Astros of all time. I really like Ryan Pressly since they acquired him that first year that they got him. He was just I think he was the best pitcher in baseball. They had acquired him in late July. From that July to the next July, he was like virtually unhittable. He's had injuries. He's not as good as he was. I think he started to slip just a little bit last year. And I don't know. I think part of why they got Hader was because they lost Neris and that and Stanek and Maton just to kind of give them another option. But I think also part of it is they saw that Pressly was slipping a little bit, or at least were worried that Pressly was slipping a little bit last year. Nothing that he's doing right now is what he did last year. So I just can't believe he's actually slipped that far. I don't know if it's the catcher situation. I don't know if it's I'm not the closer anymore, and even though I said all the right things, again, closers are such weird people. Like, it's amazing how many closers, when they're not in closing situations, pitch terrible. It's been happening for decades. Drives me crazy. It's mental midget stuff. And but like right now, he I don't know that he's had a good outing, really. Now, he's had some outings where he had an outing a couple days ago where he came in and they hit a shot to center and a shot to center and he got another out and he didn't give up any runs, but he wasn't pitching well. They just hit the ball hard at people. Like, this is a huge, like, Pressly has got to get better. Like, you could argue he lost yesterday's game. Now, again, I really think Yonner Diaz was the reason why they lost yesterday's game. He was my number one reason why they lost the game yesterday. And when you're going as bad as the Astros are,
go ahead. I just had to jump in on what I just want to know what you mean by Yonner Diaz before I.
Okay, I'm going to explain that. Going as bad as the Astros are going right now, And you're just looking for some glimpse of, oh, maybe they can come out of it here. Maybe this is it. And they were down 2-1. They scored two runs. Tucker got a hit. Some got a couple big hits. You're up 3-2. You got runners on second and third and one out. And Yiner came to the plate with a chance to deliver to coup de grace and to make you think, well, finally they're coming out of it. And he struck out. And I'm like, nope, nothing's changed. Same thing. That was the chance to say, okay, we're coming out of this funk that they've been in, and we're actually going to have a big inning at home, theoretically, you know, gets a good team. And the minute he struck out, I'm like, they're not going to win this game.
And you see,
there are times in games when you have huge – that was just a humongous at-bat.
And
that's awful.
And again, that is why last year I still – and we're on the same page here. When everybody was clamoring for Yiner Diaz to play every single day, Dusty Baker knew what he was doing. And it's unfortunate that the other option was maybe the worst offensive player in the last 10 years in Major League Baseball in Martin Maldonado, although Jose Abreu this year is going to make a run for that title. But Yiner Diaz is a really good player that's going to get better. But he still does not understand the difference in certain at-bats in certain situations. And it's why, which last year this time I was making fun of Mauricio Dubon all the time and we were joking about him.
Yeah.
I hadn't watched enough Mauricio Dubon before last season to understand, but he's the type of player that I love because he understands the difference between a first inning at-bat and a ninth inning at-bat, or an at-bat with a runner on third and one out, and an at-bat. And it's unfortunately the way the entire game is now. There's not that many guys like Dubon out there. And Kyle Tucker's the same way. I don't enjoy when Kyle Tucker's up in clutch situations. Now, he's a very good major league hitter, so there's a lot of times where he hits a double into the gap. But to your point and to my point, there's a lot of times that I don't want him to try to hit a double into the gap, and he always will. Yordan Alvarez, I wonder if it's just that he's that good that he always comes through anyway because he's one of the best hitters in the world. But Alvarez, to me, feels like he understands big at-bats, and he understands what he should be trying to do. And
I don't think Altuve understands anything.
Well, he might just be good enough for it doesn't matter. But I think there's certain guys, and he doesn't ever strike out in those spots for the most part because he puts the ball in play anyway. But there's guys who don't, and Yiner Diaz is the worst on the team by far in not being able to differentiate. And again,
He's a young player.
And look, that's the other thing.
There are people that think I hate the guy. I love Yiner Diaz. But that doesn't mean I want him hitting in the 4-5 hole for me.
And it's the other thing that I struggle with. And right now Joe Espada's catching a lot of flack, which, again, it's because fans are frustrated. So when he says anything about Jose Abreu, he's going to get flack. He's saying most of the same things Dusty said last year about Abreu. But people, you know, freaked out because he said the back of the baseball card. But my point, which it's not about his conversation about Abreu, is that Yiner Diaz, when you look back at the end of the season, is going to have great numbers offensively. But that doesn't mean he's a great situational hitter. And I think yesterday was just another example of that.
Yeah, I thought that the minute that happened, I was like, they're in trouble. They haven't changed. I mean, it's the same awful at-bats at the wrong time when they're at home. And it's been going on for years. And no, that's what lost the game yesterday. But you could also argue that Presley did too. Obviously, I'm really worried about Ryan Presley. Number two word is Ren McCormick, Chaz McCormick. I'm really worried, and I wouldn't be so worried about McCormick if they had another outfielder. Like, they don't have another outfielder. Like, all year long, I'm like, they only have one outfielder. Jake Myers is terrible. I do not want him on the team. I don't care what analytics say. He's just a goofball. He doesn't understand. You were talking about understanding situations. I don't even think Jake Myers knows what a situation is. Like, if you say, Jake, you got to do better in this situation, I think what he's going through his mind is, what is a situation? Like, I've never seen a player look more clueless on the field than Jake Myers, ever. Ever. I mean, why is he on my team? But I'm worried about McCormick because here's the other problem. And maybe that'll solve it. Like, the other problem with Diaz is when he DHs, he can't hit. He hits better when he catches. And El Pedro hits better when he plays left field. The problem with playing El Perro in left field, we have this idea because he's had bad knees and legs before that it's going to wear down on him more. But they might have to do that a lot more often. They really might. My third, there's a lot of things that can be third. Am I worried about Hader? Yeah, but I'm not really worried about him yet. I guess I'm more worried about Bregman because of the whole contractual situation. And is he really still an elite player? I think Bregman would have to be third on my list. You say, well, where's Abreu? I'm not even worried about Abreu because that's going to take care of itself. Like, he's playing so bad that they've already moved an outfielder into AAA to first base. Like, there are already things in motion to solve that issue. If he starts hitting, then fine. If he doesn't hit, then that's going to take care of itself. I'm not worried about Abreu because if he keeps doing terrible, he's gone. I mean, then he's not going to keep playing like this. And then in June, I mean, or July or August, he's still going to be there. No, but Presley might. And McCormick might, or they will be. So, man, Presley, oh, that is the number one concern right now. He has got to get better, or I don't know if the it's still early thing is going to mean anything long term. We'll take a timeout and be back.
You're listening to ESPN 103.7 Lafayette and 104.1 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station. Your home for the Houston Astros.
Welcome back. You are listening to ESPN 103.7 Live at 104.1 Lake Charles. All right. Astros are too depressing to talk about. I'm sure our next guest maybe want to talk about all this surprising early hitting by the Milwaukee Brewers. What is going on over there? I'll let him say that, but also want to remind you our poll question of the day is about the Saints draft. What are the Saints going to pick? So what are the choices, Dawson? And then we'll ask Luke to answer that question first.
Yeah, it's offensive tackle, which we expect to be the favorite in the voting. Defensive line, wide receiver, and then other are your other options here.
All right, Luke, what do you think?
If I'm handicapping this, I think the things I'm looking for first and second round are offensive tackle first and foremost. Yeah, obviously that could change if somebody you're not expecting to be there is there. You know, if one of those top three receivers falls somehow to number 14 or within range for you to trade up for him and get him, then sure, I get it. But, you know, I think just the way this draft is lining up, with the tackles in this class, I just think it makes a lot of sense for that to be your move for round one. And then round two, I think it'd go a lot of different directions, but yeah, I like the kind of that area for a receiver. I think they could still use some help there. They've got two really good options, but you know they need somebody to kind of fill that role that Michael Thomas was supposed to fill these last 4 years. They never really figured it out. So yeah, I think that's kind of where I'd be leaning with those first two picks, and we'll kind of see how it falls on draft day. Maybe it's just there that they just have to pick at that spot.
Okay, so
there's a lot of different positions where they need help.
Okay, so I had Ross Jackson on last week and I asked him this question, and I'm still not comfortable with. Everyone is saying tackle and receiver. So I think certainly the offensive tackle is without question. I mean, everyone understands that one. The wide receiver one, if they draft a good wide receiver, am I going to be upset? Of course not. But this deep need for one. Like, you mentioned Michael Thomas. Who in the world, other than this insanity of late of trading up to get Malik Nabers, where I have no idea where that comes from or how anyone thinks that's very realistic, who in the world is going to come in as a rookie and Derek Carr is going to have a Drew Brees, Michael Thomas relationship with as a rookie receiver next year? Like, who in the world could that person be?
Well, I see. I don't think you need to be looking at it that way. Like, you can't look at it as who's going to come in and catch 90 passes for 1,100 yards as a rookie. You know, I think the thing you got to consider is this piece that's been missing in their offense, and that's they've got two guys right now who are really good field stretching options, but they don't have anybody on this roster right now who they can kind of consistently go to move the chains. Who's their clutch receiver?
Okay, so who would that be?
Well, you know, I really like I don't think he's going to be there, but you know, you just never know. I really like the idea of Keon Coleman in the second round, if he's there or if he's attainable, you know, if he falls to 39, 40.
I think he'll be there then.
Yeah. I just don't know if he's going to be there at 45. There's a lot of different kind of differing opinions on him. I think the only reason he's even remotely considered as an option there is because he ran a 4.6 40 at the combine, which is pretty similar to what Michael Thomas ran. I think that number has kind of dropped him a little bit, but I think he plays faster than that number, and he'd add an element to this offense that they're missing right now, which is somebody who making contested catches, who's a big target, a possession receiver. He's one that I'm really keeping an eye on, and if he's even remotely close, I don't see how you couldn't pull the trigger there. And obviously, he's a Louisiana native. There's the connections there, but he's everything this offense is missing right now from a receiver standpoint, from a pass catching standpoint.
So you don't think Xavier Leggett more than him?
No, I don't think so. I think if Leggett is there, he's a good option. But I think if you had the choice between those two, I would much rather have Coleman over Leggett. I think there's other this is not the same offense that they've been running, obviously. So, when you look at some of the things that San Francisco did really, really well, they were an offense that got the ball in receivers' hands and let them make plays after they made the catch. So I think you could look at that and be like, okay, maybe instead we're looking at this wrong. Instead of thinking about a possession receiver, a move the chains receiver, they need a run after catch receiver. I think then you could look at somebody like Malachi Corley of Western Kentucky, who's kind of like Debo Samuel light, right? I think there's just a lot of different ways they could take that position. But frankly, right now, I mean they've got two options, two proven options. You can feel pretty good about what A.T. Perry did in the back half of the season, but is he going to be able to keep that up? Is he going to be a fit in this new offense? Yeah, you just don't know. So I just think that it's something that you have to kind of bolster. But again, like they have weak spots all over this roster. They don't have a second starting safety right now. Jordan Howden played pretty well as a rookie, but like, are you going to trust him to go in there and be your guy? And who's the depth behind him? Jonathan Abram. Yeah, I think they could draft a safety in the second round. They could draft a corner in the second round. Paulson Debo's going to be a free agent next year. We don't know what's going to happen with Marshon Lattimore. They could draft a defensive tackle, defensive end, even after signing Chase Young. There's so many different ways they can go with this. But I think if it's me and I'm looking at what are some of their top needs right now, it's offensive tackle number one, and receiver just in second, with a lot of things closely following receiver.
Well, you see, I you kind of stole my next question. I think safety's the biggest, second biggest need, and it's not even close. Like, Honey Badger's old. I like Howden too, but I'm nowhere near saying Howden is going to be the starter at safety for the next 6 or 7 years. Who else? I mean, Abram is. He played a little better last year than I thought. I mean, I don't understand how anybody could not think safety is the second biggest need.
Yeah, I think when you're looking at this, though, like the draft is a huge part of building your roster on a year-to-year basis, but it's also how you're building your team for the long run. And I think when you're looking at these, like you can't just outside of offensive tackle, which is both a premium position and a biggest need. I think you got to look at which of these high picks are going to be positions that are premium positions. So that positions that this guy, receivers now are making $35 million a year, at the top of the market. and the mid-tier of the market are making $20 million a year. Now they're making offensive tackle, they're making right tackle money. So I think if you hit on somebody with one of your high picks there, that's value. And I think that's why receiver early makes a lot more sense to me than safety. There's still right now like six starting caliber safeties on the free agent market. You know, it's a position that has been
right
severely devalued.
Right, and they could easily sign one of those. And I think that's a good point. But I'm talking about your economic weighing position. All of that makes sense. But I think I'm more worried about safety moving forward in the next year or two than I am wide receiver. Is what I'm saying.
I agree with that. Like as in terms of like what is a bigger need right now. Yes, but I just don't think that. I think it'd be irresponsible to go into a draft and say like we need our quick fixes right now, especially just considering the depth of this receiver class. I think it's really good through three rounds. I think after that, you
okay. What about Brian Thomas?
I mean, I like him as a potential first round option. I just think that I liked him a lot more before the Ramczyk news came out. You know, I think. Once they started saying like we're really concerned about Ramczyk going into the season, now you're like, okay, you have no good tackle options on the team right now. You know, it's such a like that's one where it's like it's a premium position and it's addressing immediate and long term need. I just don't see like unless something crazy happens and like the Chargers they put it at number five and they take Joe Alt and then the Titans are like, well, now we got to take Olufashinu, and then the Raiders like, well, we want Fuaga, and you know.
Well, again, I think like, all three of those are going to be gone. So if that happens, do you think they like Fotanu that much, or what do you think they would do at that point?
Well, let's say three tackles are taken before they pick, I wouldn't say likely, but I think that's like a 40% chance that happens, right? Maybe 35. I think that for me, the choice would come down to, if he's there, I really like J.C. Latham. But every one of those guys comes with pretty big question marks. J.C. Latham never played left tackle in college. Fatanu's a little bit undersized to play tackle in the NFL, and a lot of people are thinking maybe he's a better guard than a tackle. I don't think he could take Amarius Mims, just considering the history they have with these like big home run swings in the first round.
I don't want
they need somebody to play right away. I don't know if you feel really comfortable taking a guy only on athletic traits. You know, so maybe in that scenario, maybe you're like, okay, well, look, we have Brian Thomas ranked way higher than all these guys. Or like, if three tackles are drafted, you have Brock Bowers, maybe he's there. You know, I think then it becomes a little bit tougher decision. You can say like, we'll try to address tackle in the second round because I think there's going to be some pretty good players there available still too. I think if Fashanu is there, I would run to the podium to draft him.
Well, yeah, but I really think the Bears could easily pick tackle. The Titans could easily pick tackle. The Jets could easily pick tackle. I mean, and you mentioned
the Raiders,
the Chargers. Although I think they should pick a receiver. But.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a possibility that the field is depleted by the time the Saints come around at 14. You know, they have to be prepared to go a different direction in round one. I think there's, let's see, five tackles that I'd be willing to draft at 14. I think one of them is going to be there.
All right. We'll take a timeout, and then I'm going to bring up when we come back another position that I hope they don't go if that scenario happens. But I'm going to ask Luke if he thinks it's how possible he thinks it is that they would go in that direction. We'll do that after this timeout. Stay tuned.
Go check out our YouTube channel at ESPN_SWLA for the latest episodes of Miguez Mindset, Over Par, and so much more. That's ESPN Southwest Louisiana Sports Station on YouTube.
Welcome back to Footnotes. We're speaking with Luke Johnson of theadvocateandnola.com. All right, a couple things. We only got about 4 or 5 minutes, so a couple things I want to get to. What are the chances of the three tackles that most people think are gone, like I'm saying, and there's not a wide receiver there that they will want to pick quite that high. The top three receivers are gone. Please tell me they're not going to go Murphy or Newton route.
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think, if three tackles are gone, there's going to be four quarterbacks taken in the top, let's say, 11.
Yeah.
And that nobody's going to be behind Minnesota, you know, J.J. McCarthy or otherwise. So four quarterbacks, there's going to be three receivers gone at least. You're talking about, what is that? 11 picks out of 13 in front of them.
Right.
There's going to be somebody there. I don't think that their hand is going to be forced to take a defensive tackle. And look, I think that tackle is something they definitely could address in draft, maybe as high as the second round. They got a pretty good rookie season out of Brian Percy, and Shepard and Saunders were fine. But I think they could get better there. And, you know, they obviously got to replace Malcolm Roach in the rotation. They got to have a fourth guy there. But I just don't think that I think typically like defensive interior is not a position they kind of traditionally, especially like a nose tackle type.
Right. I agree. Yeah, I agree.
In the first round.
All right. I'm just telling you, if Brock Bowers is there and they don't take him, I will cry. So you don't seem
Bowers
as high.
There, none of the tackles you like are there.
Right. No, if they draft tackle, I'm fine with it because it's like I said, the Saints are homeless right now. They don't have a foundation. They're a homeless football team. Without an offensive line, you have no home. So I get that. But Brock Bowers is the toy that I would love to have. Why can't he be Michael Thomas?
No, he would be. That's the thing. Like, you know, I think people can't look at him like a tight end. I know there's this history of tight ends and first round tight ends not really living up to their draft position, but like he is essentially a wide receiver, right? Hey, that's what you're bringing him in for. And like I said earlier, that run after catchability is so important in this offense, this Clint Kubiak offense that they're bringing in. Brock Bowers might be the best run after catch player in this draft. Period. The guy averaged like almost 9 yards after the catch last year at Georgia. He's really, really, really good with the ball in his hands. And if there's a situation where, like we're talking about, three, four tackles are gone, all the top three receivers are gone, four quarterbacks are gone, Brock Bowers is going to be there. That's going to have to be, you know, if the tackle options are kind of cleaned out, I think that's got to be an option for him.
And you would support that?
100%.
Yes.
I think he's going to be a very special player. And this is kind of like what we're talking about. This is like a building block type of player. I would 100% support that.
And we only got a less than a minute, but do you think there's any way that they think higher of Penning than we do?
Absolutely. I also don't think there's any way they can just go into a season trusting that the light switch is going to flick on. You know, I definitely think they still believe in him. And that he's going to have a role on this team. Like, he's not just going to sit on the bench like he did last year. But the question is, where is that going to be?
Yeah.
You know, is he going to play guard? Is he going to be a sixth offensive lineman and then still develop him?
Right.
Yeah, they can't go into it thinking like he is definitely going to take that job.
Absolutely. We ran out of time. I appreciate it. Thanks, Luke.
This is ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station. This is 2 hours of sports talk like none other. Footnotes with the man who speaks his own language.
Me feel English? That's impossible.
Your host, Kevin Foote.
Welcome back to Footnotes. You are listening to ESPN 103.7 Lafayette, 104.1 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station, broadcasting live from the EFCO Development Studios in Upper Lafayette. You can give us a call on the Mike's Marine Hotline at 337-706-0111. Brought to you by Mike's Marine, keeping you on the water. All right, last Thursday, we had Ross Jackson on. The thing that I took away from that was he seemed to think that the Saints are higher on Fatanu, the tackle, maybe guard from Washington, than most people are thinking. After talking to Luke, he sounds like he thinks the Saints are higher on Latham than most people are thinking. Neither one of those are these top three tackles that almost everyone is projecting to go in some or, well, almost everyone has Alt first and either Fuaga second or Fashanu second, whichever. I mean, whichever way you go. But those top three. So I guess the Saints are a little different situation than a lot of teams looking for linemen. The knock on Latham supposedly is that he's not a left tackle, he's a right tackle. Well, the Saints could need a left tackle and a right tackle. They're homeless. I mean, they could need both. And so I don't know which one to believe. Like, they both seem to think with different people. If you buy that there's some truth in both, maybe in the Saints, I wouldn't think this is the case, but I guess it's possible that in the Saints' mind, they're fine with any of the five. Normally, to me, my perception is it doesn't work that way. You kind of get, you know, if there are five, then, you know, a team might like three of them a lot and the other two not so much or something, or, you know, something like that. But I guess it's always possible that they like all five and that they would take any one of those five, and certainly two of those five are going to be there. I think now Luke seemed to think that it's less than a 50% chance that all three will be gone. Some people think the Chargers are going to take a lineman. I think the Chargers have to take a wide receiver to me. But would it really shock you if the Titans take a lineman, or the Bears take a lineman, or the Jets take a lineman, or the Raiders take a lineman? I mean, that's four teams that I think at least a 50% chance, if not a better than a 50% chance, that they could take linemen. So why couldn't three of those four teams take linemen? I don't know why. Now, you know, the Jets and the Bears are essentially not in as bad a situation as the Saints, but a similar. Like, almost everyone is saying for the Jets, you have Aaron Rodgers. You have this great defense. You have a good running back. You've bolstered your wide receiver situation. You have to pick an offensive tackle. You have to. But same thing we're saying in New Orleans. But if Brock Bowers is there, is he too tempting, like we were just talking about with Luke? So if the Jets go with the offensive tackle, same thing with the Bears. If you draft a young quarterback number one, which all of us are convinced is going to happen, do you add another wide receiver when you've already got two really good wide receivers now? You traded for one, and he had a good year last year, and you traded for another one. Or do you pick the offensive tackle to support your rookie quarterback? You got it. Why would you not go offensive tackle? So I think it's very possible that all three are going to be gone. Now, if one of them's there and they like him, I think they're going to take him, even if Bowers is there. But I'm surprised at how many people don't think it's at least a 50-50 chance that all three tackles are going to go. All of that leads into our poll question of the day, and what are the updates so far on that, sir?
Yeah, and I mean, look, it's not the most deceiving question, asking where the Saints are going to go in the first round. I knew offensive tackle would be the overwhelming majority, but I wanted to see how far into that, you know, the people leaned, and 90% so far have gone O tackle, 5% receiver, 5% other. So, you know, the funny thing about it is I thought some people would say D-line just because the Saints are so tempted to take D-line every year, you know, and I wondered if that would leak in again. I think this year it's pretty clear that they probably can't afford to because they already invested a lot in Chase Young, and they have the other rookies that they've invested in as well, in Bresee and Foskey, who they can't give up on, and obviously Bresee did show you some signs. But I did want to put it in there just to see if people think that the Saints would just, you know,
Do you include edge rusher in that category?
Yeah, defensive line, I would consider an interior D-tackle or an edge rusher.
So, I mean, I think most people think Turner's going to be gone already from Alabama.
Yeah, the Saints haven't had success drafting edge players named Turner, so I don't know.
What about UCLA? Some people of late, I've seen more people of late say the Broncos are going to take him, and I don't know how in the world the Broncos could take him.
Yeah, I mean, he's a good player. I like the player. I like the skill set. From a need perspective, again, the Saints, if they're taking based on need, there's no way they can take an edge rusher. There's no way they can do it.
I agree.
And again, even if you don't have like a ton of confidence in Chase Young, you have to. It's one of those deals where you go, man, why is this guy playing more than that guy when the skill levels are comparable? Well, the investment in one is way bigger than the other, so he's going to get more chances. That's just the bottom line. And the Saints, they can't afford to not give Chase Young every opportunity. And drafting a first-round player at that position when Cam Jordan's still at least going to play a lot, they wouldn't be able to do it. I don't see any way they draft an edge player.
Look, Luke's explanation to my question I've been having about the wide receiver makes sense. From a contractual standpoint, it's a lot easier to sign a veteran safety at a reasonable price than it is a veteran wide receiver or, you know, an impact-type wide receiver. So that part makes total sense. And look, I'm not saying if the Saints don't pick a safety in the second round, it's bad. But in terms of just need, again, I'm not talking about finances 2 years down the road or 3 years down the road. I'm talking about need. I think they need a safety more than they need a wide receiver. But wide receivers do cost a lot more. And so I get that part. Same thing with offensive tackle. The reason why I've never really minded liking the Saints drafting offensive tackles, although for the first however many years, 50 years or the franchise or so, they've had great success drafting offensive tackles. Of late, the success rate is kind of slipping for whatever reason. I don't know if it's their model needs to be tweaked like we talked about last week or what, but and the reason why is you have to spend so much money to get a good offensive tackle on the market. Same logic that Luke was saying about why you would pick a wide receiver. So I totally get that, and it all makes sense. But, man, I think if they can draft the tight end, and again, if they – the people who are saying they're going to trade up for Malik Neighbors, first of all, I think that's just insanity. Would I love to have Malik Neighbors? Of course I would. But how can the Saints afford right now to trade up? Now, if you could really trade up, if they like him that much and you could trade up by giving, you know, two fifth round picks or something, then do it. But I don't know that they could do that for that. I think there's so many game changing players from quarterbacks to receivers. I mean, you're not talking about trading up for a defensive tackle. You're talking about trading up for a playmaking wide receiver or a quarterback. I don't see that happen. So I just think that part is insanity to me. And I think Brock Bowers has a way better chance of being that Michael Thomas role that he's talking about and a lot of people, that Luke was talking about and a lot of people are talking about, than a rookie wide receiver. Like the guy Mitchell, I think is talented. I think all these receivers are talented. And by the way, I meant like the Keon Coleman. You watch Keon Coleman play at Florida State way more than I. To me, Keon Coleman is a jump ball guy.
No.
Am I wrong there?
Well, I think that's what Florida State made him into. But I think if you ask, we talked to his agent a while back, and I know that's not the least biased person to talk to. But there was a lot left in the route tree that Florida State didn't utilize just because they had a lot of other skilled receivers that played those roles for him. I think there's more to Keon than what you saw at Florida State. And if you go back to Michigan State the year before, you'd have seen a lot more of that as well.
So you think he can be a possession receiver? He's not just a jump ball guy.
Yeah, the biggest concern with Keon is he doesn't have top-end breakaway speed, but what he does have, and I listened to Todd McShay talk about him, and he did kind of a pretty deep dive on him, he's got the ability to separate at the top of routes, which is just one of those innate abilities that some receivers have and some don't. And so, yeah, like Michael Thomas, it was the same way. I'm not saying he's Michael Thomas, but I see a lot of characteristics that remind me of Thomas. But he's got more, I think, vertical upside athleticism down the field. So, look, I think there's sometimes you see that ability to separate at the college level, and it just doesn't happen because then, NFL corners are better. If he's able to still be able to get the separation late in routes that he was in college, I think he's got the opportunity to be a player that makes plays at all three levels. He catches everything. That's another big upside for him.
I think he's going to be there when the Saints pick in the second round.
In the second round? I mean, yes. I don't know if he lasts that long. I think if he doesn't go late first, I think somebody early in the second is going to see the upside.
There are a lot of really good receivers.
And that's the benefit, right? And that's why, and I love listening to McShay's logic on a lot of this stuff because, his point of view is always, the other thing that teams look at, too, is what they're going to have to pay that player in that slot, right? And that's why when you're taking a player in the first round, again, that's some of the stuff that plays into why you take certain positions. And if you get the quarterback for that price, well, it's a quarterback, so you're willing to pay it. But if you can get a highly productive receiver that's going to be on your team for a long time and you get him at a second-round cost, which is, again, the slotted contracts, that's a massively valuable thing to grab. So that's why I would not be upset if the Saints took a guy like Keon in the second round. But specifically Keon, I don't know if he gets that far. Because that's an overall pick in their second round is what, number 40, what is that, 45?
But yeah, but I mean, you think there are 10 wide receivers that are going to be gone by then?
Not necessarily.
Like, I mean, I think teams that are going to pick wide receiver like the Chiefs and maybe the Bills, to me, they're going to take Brian Thomas, Mitchell, Worthy, guys with speed over Keon.
Well, but the thing that I wonder about is when you get to that next group of receivers with like the Ladd McConkeys of the world, I think Coleman goes first out of those guys, and I think that'll be early in the second.
Okay, you mentioned, is Ladd McConkey Hunter Renfrow?
There's an argument to be made. I think people think he's got more upside than Renfrow did.
Because, I mean, he could be there in the second round. And they've been talking about the Saints picking up Hunter Renfrow for 2 years.
Yeah, I don't think that's the skill set that you need, to be honest with you. I think Olave does a lot of the things McConkey would be able to do, and he does them better. Now, Olave's consistency and everything like that is still a question mark, but I don't know if you need I value what Keon brings to the Saints receiving core more than what McConkey or Roman Wilson or those types of reliable route running intermediate type receivers.
Look, I don't think the guy from Western Kentucky is intriguing, by the way. And he's shooting up the draft boards. But I think Leggett is not going to be there, but he's the one that I would kind of like to have. But I don't think he'll be there in the second round.
Yeah, I think Leggett is somewhat similar to the Coleman upside level, where you've got this bigger physical receiver who, we've seen a lot of those guys that get drafted, and I'm not comping him to DK Metcalf, but that type of player that maybe falls a little bit more than you think, but then you go, hey, at the end of the day, there's just not that many humans that are built the way he's built. And if you turn him into, if you polish him up a little bit, which Seattle's done a nice job with, you have a number one guy. So I do understand that idea about Leggett. Like, that's the, I think that's the idea that people push back against with some of the other receivers that maybe are more polished players right now, are great route runners. Ricky Pearsall's the other name that's I think going to go around the time that Keon Coleman's going to go, and I'll be interested to see if a team takes Pearsall over Keon, because Pearsall has the higher upside athleticism. He's a more explosive player. I don't know if he's got the he doesn't have the ball skills Coleman has, but that's all fascinating. Like, it's just going to depend on what the team is looking at. And for the Saints, like,
he's a popular Saints second round projection.
Yeah, but I think Pearsall, like, and maybe it's good to have two guys that do it, but I think Pearsall has a lot of Shaheed characteristics, and I don't know if you need another player like that. So that's where I start to, again, I value what Coleman does, because I think it's a real void in what the Saints have.
That is fair. We'll take a timeout and be back.
The biggest headlines in the world of sports are discussed here. ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
Welcome back to Footnotes. You are listening to ESPN 1037 Lafayette, 1041 Lake Charles. We've been talking lots of NFL draft today. And, you know, look, a week from today is going to be the draft. And so it is the first round anyway. And so it's fascinating because it seems like there are a lot of it seems pretty obvious, but what seems obvious doesn't always take place. You know, nationally, they're doing a lot of freaking out because Raymond's little Commanders a week before the draft is, you know, essentially they have the two pick, but really they have the one pick. Because everybody knows what's going to happen at one. And so, like, they've known for that for a while. Like, so, you know, the first decision with any kind of a, oh, no, what is the team before is going to do should be at three. But what do the Commanders do? They bring in not Caleb Williams, because everybody knows where he's going. They bring in the next, or at least theoretically, their next four quarterbacks. They bring them all in a week before the draft. And if you believe the rhetoric, they haven't decided yet. A week before the draft, when they've had months to do this. So I'd be a little surprised if they really haven't decided yet. But why would you bring all four in a week before the draft if you haven't decided yet? I don't know. Kind of strange. All right, let's head back out to the Mike's Marine hotline. Mike's Marine, keeping you on the water.
Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
Kevin, I want to talk about the Cajuns. But first of all, let me say something about the Astros. You know, Kevin, you let several good, very good relievers walk, and yet you paid a reliever more money than anybody's ever paid a reliever. Do you think it would have been better served if they would have kept what they had and not paid what hated what they paid them?
Well, certainly, yes. Now, again, I also think that one of the reasons why they did is because they were worried that Presley was slipping. Now, Presley struggles this year. Could be that they were right and that he is slipping. And I can't believe he slipped that far. Or Presley's troubles are because he's really not too fine about being the closer. And then all of a sudden they bring in this other closer and he's mentally not adjusted and he's all being mental midget like closers get, you know. You know, I still think it's mental midget. I'm not in a close situation, so I can't pitch well. I've never understood or that aggravated me for years. And I thought he was above that, but maybe he's not. But, yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, they would have just go ahead and they would have been better served just to cut Presley and make a bring you their clothes. But anyhow, the Cajuns. Did you question Diggs or anybody question Diggs when he put that all that severely offensive lineup last night, not worrying about any defense? Because, Kevin, I think what he did there, he's getting a preparation for a lineup. He's going to start in Coastal because he knows he's going to need a smash ball. I mean, putting LaFleur in center, that means he found a place to put Kupp in. And, look, by the way, I think that freshman's going to be real good. And then if that happens, then you also have room for Pastore and Amadi. That lineup right there is your most offensive lineup you could put on the field. And I think he wanted to get a look at that before you went to post.
It's an interesting thought. Man, LaFleur's legs are just so fragile. I just don't know how much center field he could play.
One weekend. We're talking about, I think he's getting ready for this weekend. You know, and he knows he's going to need to smash the ball. And you put your most offensive lineup and your best offensive players out there.
Oh, I mean, I'm with you with it being the best lineup offensively.
I want to chime in. I like the thought a lot. I don't know for sure, though, if he's actually going to throw Connor Cuff out there in a series like this, because I don't know if he thinks Cuff's ready for those types of at-bats, but he might. I mean, he might do it. I don't know.
Well, let me tell you, when Dex has a hunch about something, and look, he talks nothing but good about that person.
Oh, no, he's talented. No, you can see the talent, yes.
And, you know, he reminds me of what we thought Higgs would be like last year until Higgs went off. You know, the problem with Higgs last year was he wasn't getting the playing time. Once he got the playing time, boy, he just shot up.
By the way, I
really like that freshman. And I just think, watch out, that's what Diggs is trying to do, fellas. Y'all have a good day.
Take care. Do we trust him defensively, though?
Well, and again, I guess that's his point, is maybe Diggs is conceding, as great as the pitching staff's been, you're going to have to win a couple of these games 10-8, and that's, you know, I've got some numbers I'm going to run through when I look at the Coastal series, either today or tomorrow on our show, but that's an interesting thought for sure. I don't know if he's willing to do that, though, and I don't think he's going to put LaFleur in center field in this Coastal series. I don't know if you can roll the dice that much with, again, you've got three starting pitchers right now who are dealing. Do you really want to mess with what's behind them, you know? Or maybe you just, look, he's been in that ballpark. Maybe he just knows.
I've never been there. Is range and all of that, like, that's a big deal at Teague Moore Field. Is that not a big deal there?
Because right, the ball well, anything just flies. Right, anything that's hit well is gone is, I think, the idea. And, you know, I've been digging into it, and again, I'll have the numbers, the exact numbers on our show, but, like, Coastal hits a lot of homers, but they give up a ton of homers, too, because of how it's just the ballpark. It's got to be, right? It's at some point. Now, look, Coastal's also to the point, it's like the Yankees, right, where you're going to build a lineup around what you have. Coastal's recruited around their ballpark. They want to hit homers, so part of it is they're that good offensively. But, no, I think I see a lot of what he's saying. But, yeah, Higgs last night. Remember there was a two-week stretch where Higgs looked lost at the plate? He doesn't look lost anymore. He hit two homers. One he yanked to right field. One he hit the other way. I mean, you hit two homers, one to left, one to right. That's impressive stuff. Again, and Southeastern threw some of their really good arms. It wasn't like he did it against a team that was throwing, you know, freshmen out there.
When he starts hitting the left center, you know, it's kind of like when Perro's hitting the left center. I just really like it. And I've been waiting. Connor Higgs is probably my favorite player on the whole team. I mean, he's just like a 12-year-old when out there playing, and I just when he was so good at the end of last season at the plate, and he seems like he's entering one of those, you know, periods where he's really swinging the bat well. I really like Pastore. I mean, he got another hit to right field. You know, there's a lot to like about where they are potentially offensively playing in this, and maybe they can pitch. I mean, I don't think they're going to have like an Old Dominion pitching weekend or a Marshall pitching weekend, but that doesn't mean pitching can't still dominate the series. I mean, if these are high scoring games and they're winning 8-4, pitching can still be a huge advantage here.
Yeah, and I would say reset your expectations going into it. Like if you get a starter that gives you 6 innings and gives up 5 runs, that might not be a bad thing at all. Like you're not going to go 6 innings shutout baseball in this ballpark, unless it's a weird weekend, maybe the wind's blowing in or something. But I was going to say my biggest takeaway about last night, even though I also made some notes about Connor Cuff, is that Blake McGehee looked like he's back as a factor, and Jack Martinez was throwing 98 with a nasty breaking ball. And there was a specific at-bat for Martinez where I loved the adjustment. He threw what was either a fastball or kind of a sinker first pitch, and it got roped down the left field line foul. And it was kind of a clear, like, oh, okay, I'm not throwing him that again. He went nasty breaking ball. It was a sawed-off, sword-looking swing for a swing and miss, and another nasty breaking ball caught third strike right down the middle. And I went, that's a guy who seems like he's starting to figure some things out on the mound. And if you have Martinez and McGehee as kind of those middle relief back-end options in a weekend series like this, that's a big factor for them.
I think if Martinez can become, from here on out, I mean, who cares what he's done from the beginning to now? If he can become an effective option for him and be the pitcher they thought from here on out, man, and get anything from McGehee. And with everybody, because Etheridge looks like, it just seems like the pitching staff's starting to come together. Like, and it's been really good for a while now. But it seems like early on when it wasn't as good as all the early accolades, it's because Etheridge wasn't doing what he was supposed to be doing. And he seems to be there again. McGehee was not doing what he was supposed to be doing. He seems like he's there again. Martinez was not doing what he was supposed to be doing. And it looks like he might be. And, you know, everyone else is getting a little healthier, it seems like. So, like, Carson wasn't real healthy for a while, and it looks like he is. So, man, it's a lot of things to be excited about with baseball, for sure. We'll take a timeout and be back.
Helping you get through your workday. This is ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
Welcome back. You are listening to ESPN 1037 Lafayette, 1041 Lake Charles. Once again, you can give us a call on the Mike's Marine Hotline, 706-0111, brought to you by Mike's Marine, keeping you on the water. All right, so the Cajuns after last night are still, what, 52-53, right, in the RPI when I looked this morning. If they win one or two games this weekend, say they win two games this weekend, are you looking at jumping up 8 to 10 spots, or what would be your expectation?
Yeah, I would. If they win one game, I would expect them to be right around 50. Not much movement at all, basically. If they win two games, I think they'd get into the 45 range. And if they swept the series, I think they'd be in the low 40s. That's my guess. And again, it all depends on a lot of other stuff too, but that would be my guess.
So I was having this discussion. I still am not 100% clear on how all these different things work. In high school football, and I know that high school football is a lot simpler than college baseball. I understand that. But there's still some of the basic premise carries over. In high school football, there were essentially two power ranking systems. One of them just tells you where you are right now in the games that you play. Like, say it's week 7 of the season. It only matters the first 6 teams you played. The other one gives you the points already that you're going to get for your week 8, 9, and 10 opponent. Now, you don't know if you beat them or not. That comes once you play them. But it gives you the credit already, essentially, for your week 8, 9. Like, if in week 9 you're playing someone who's 10-0, then you already have that. That's already factored in. So I still am not 100% sure if any of these power rankings we're looking at right now does that.
The RPI, as far as I know, does not include games that have not happened yet in any capacity. And when they do play them, they will be factored in. But I do not think...
But none, the other one, this RPI Live thing.
No, RPI Live is the same thing as RPI.
What I mean, ELO? Not live. Not, yeah, the ones that supposedly projects the future.
Okay, but the problem here's the problem that I have with predicted RPI. And here's what's pretty doom and gloom for the Cajuns' perspective. Predicted RPI, but it's also why I think there's a flaw in the metric. And Warren Nolan is, again, they are as good as anybody, and so I'm not like calling out their metric here. The Cajuns' predicted RPI is for them to go 40-16 overall and go 22-8 in conference play. It has them winning 2 of 3 against Coastal, 2 of 3 against Southern Miss, sweeping Troy, but being swept by Georgia Southern and losing 2-3 to South Alabama. It's a weird match. It just predicts all the games, and every day it changes.
But I don't even want a prediction of what they're going to do. I just want credit for having those teams on my schedule. That doesn't happen, I don't think, is the point I'm getting to.
Yeah, but why? You just wait until the games happen, and then it solves itself. Yeah, the scary thing is it predicts them if they go 40-16 and have all those results that I had. Their predicted RPI is 47. But that's also predicting all the other teams that are at the top of the RPI. It heavily predicts those teams to win a lot of games, and a lot of those teams are going to lose games. So I don't look at predicted RPI much at all.
It's just so deceiving. Why can't we take away that deception and include, like, they're not suddenly going to play ULM instead of Southern Miss next weekend? So you know it's happening, so include it.
But again, the metric that would be deceiving because those games are going to the weight of those games is going to change anyway. So they just wait till they happen to factor them into the RPI. I mean, we could just be patient. It's going to happen. Once the games are played, they'll be in the system and we'll be able to figure it out.
So
the Cajuns are not getting, which is what, and we talked with Jay yesterday, the Cajuns are not getting to the top 20 in RPI. It's not happening unless they win every game the rest of the season, which is not going to happen. They're not going to be in the top 20. So it's very, very unlikely that they're going to host, in my opinion.
Oh, no, I don't think they're going to host.
So really the RPI doesn't matter other than them getting into the tournament, which again, I don't think they're going to be on the bubble either. I think they're going to be squarely in the tournament unless they collapse down the stretch.
If they win the league, they're in. It doesn't matter with their RPI.
I think I agree
fully. I think if they're second in the league, they're in. Even it doesn't matter what the RPI is.
You know, if you finish second and you go 0-2 in the conference tournament and the RPI is 60, then maybe you'd be out at that point. But yeah, if you win the conference, if you win the regular season title in the Sun Belt Conference, I think your RPI could be 58. And I think you'd still get in. I really do.
All right. Other game that took place last night here in Lafayette is the Cajun softball team. A little scary. I didn't like this game scheduled. Maybe not quite as bad as I didn't like that Louisiana Tech game in Ruston, but pretty close. Like, you're coming off a huge weekend at Texas State, and then you go to LSU on Tuesday night, and you schedule a game the next day with Nichols. I thought that was an awfully scheduled game. Awful game to schedule. Awful. But, and it's nothing in the fifth. And you're like, uh-oh, you cannot lose this game. Well, they ended up run ruling them to their credit, but again, halfway through, it was what came out of that game is that Lexi Delbray pitched 4 1/3 scoreless innings. Now, could that mean nothing? Of course, it could mean nothing. Nichols is not a terrible team, but they're not a really good team. So, could it mean absolutely nothing? Yes, but it also. And the thing about it is she threw strikes. She threw, like, I think it was 28 strikes out of 38 pitches or something crazy like that. Very efficient, very economical. And, again, I get it was Nichols. But my point is, at some point, I mean, think about it. In a regional, sometime, like, say you lose the first game of a regional. You need a third pitcher to eat up innings. And even if you don't, you might need a third pitcher to just pitch like two innings or something. Like, they have to be able to get to the point where they trust her against a pretty good team, maybe not a number one seed if you're in a regional, but to pitch a few innings or maybe more than a few innings against a 3 or a 4 seed in a regional. Like, so I don't know that last night was enough to say they're going to be able to do that, but at least it was kind of a step in the right direction. And look, she's been there, done that emotionally. Like, she's been the ace and won regionals and gone to the World Series. Now, she's not nearly as healthy as she was then, and she's had to redo, you know, her mechanics and all that. I get all of that, but hopefully they can get her to the point where, whether it's the conference tournament, although I'm not as worried about the conference tournament or in a regional, and even down the stretch, pitching some of these games against some teams that, you know, they might be way ahead of. She's got to be able to do that. So hopefully last night was a good step in that direction. We'll take a timeout and be back.
You're listening to ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station and your home for the LSU Tigers.
Welcome back. You are listening to ESPN 1037 Lafayette 1041 Lake Charles. Again, you can give us a call on the Mike's Marine Hotline, 706-0111. We've got a few minutes left. We've talked a lot of NFL draft, a lot of Cajun baseball today. Cajuns are playing, I think you could argue this weekend is the biggest weekend of the season. You know, beginning of the year, I think a lot of us were pointing to maybe Southern Miss, and that it may end up being, who knows what's going to happen between now and, I guess, next weekend. But as of right now, you'd have to say this Coastal series is the biggest, and they're both important because Southern Miss's record and standing is not as good as Coastal, but their RPI is really good, not as good as Coastal, but really good. So all of that is important. And look, again, one of the things we pointed out from the beginning, like ODU's up around 49 or 50 now. And so, the whole conference being good is and getting better at RPI is certainly a big deal. So we'll see how that's, we've been talking a lot about that. We talked a little bit about the NBA. Obviously, injuries are a huge part of what's going on right now. I don't know what to think tomorrow, and we'll talk more about this game tomorrow, the Pels and the Kings. It's a little bit scary because do you remember off the top of your head, did Zion play in all five of those games? Probably not.
He definitely didn't play in all five of them, but I'll get you an exact number in one sec.
Because, they're very guard and perimeter oriented, the Kings. I mean, they've got Sabonis in the middle, but he's not like ginormous. And so I think they can beat the Kings without Zion. I don't know that. Obviously you would need him against certain teams that you would face in the playoffs. Would you even need him against the Thunder? I'm not saying you don't need him. I'm saying matchup-wise,
well,
could you not get away with it?
I don't think you match up well with the Thunder with or without him. He did play in every Sacramento game, and his plus-minus was in the positive in all five games as well. So maybe he's a little more important to that matchup than we thought, just kind of us,
But I mean,
actually, no, correction. There's one game he was inactive. He did not play in the game against Sacramento on January the 7th. So he played in four of the five and, didn't have massive games, I wouldn't say, in all of them. He went for, let's see, he had 31 in one game, 26 in another, 25 in another, and 10 in the other. So, look, he's a player who averages right around, 23 points a game. So,
I mean, that's still a really good chunk, but I don't know. I think they can still match up with the Kings. The problem that they got to figure out, and is Zion going to help in this endeavor or not helping it? Like, why do they play so poorly at home?
Yeah, I can't figure that one out for you. He, just for the record, we talked about OKC. They played him three times. He was inactive for one. He was active for the other two. They lost the one he did not play in. They were 1-1 in the games he did play in against the Thunder. And, of course, they lost the two games at home. They won the one game on the road.
That's what I'm saying. But is that a perimeter thing? I think in these next two potential matchups, not having Zion may not. I think they can match up. Well, they're not going to be at this huge matchup deficit because Zion's not there. Because you still have a lot of other scoring options.
Yeah, but the problem is you've turned him into this like scoring leader with Ingram out, and now Ingram's back, but not really.
The problem is Ingram. Again, that was my original point. The problem is you want all your players. I'm not saying I don't want Zion. I'm saying trying to be somewhat seeing what's possible without him. The problem is not so much that you don't have Zion. It's that Ingram is not really there either.
Yeah, I agree with you.
If Ingram was Ingram, I think you would be okay without Zion. because it's not like you not learned to play without him in the last few years.
C.J. McCollum's got to play really well tomorrow.
You really do.
I don't hate him. I like him a lot.
I'm joking.
It's just when big moments happen, I need a refreshing memory to replace all the. It's like you with some of these guys you play against that are, you know, MJ Melendez. Like, you need a big moment where MJ strikes out with runners on second and third and eighth innings so you can start thinking. I need McCollum to hit a big shot in a big moment that'll stick with me. And then I can start to maybe.
But I still think he did that down the stretch at Golden State. He hit an off-balance shot from the left wing from three that was just pressure.
That's fair, but now it's do or die, so I need him to do it in that one.
Okay.
Maybe I'm being greedy.
That's fair. So,
to your point, though, the other good thing about the Pels, when they've been winning a lot of these games down the stretch, you've had some random games where Trey Murphy's gone off for 35. You've had some games where Jose Alvarado was just all over the place, maybe scoring 20, but just affecting the game. So if that's how you need to beat Sacramento is by somebody stepping up. Obviously, if McCollum goes for 40 and nobody else makes a shot, you're going to lose anyway. So that's another thing that's possible here. And Herb Jones, it's one of those guys, I know his three-point shooting percentage says he's a good three-point shooter. I can't stand any time he takes threes, and he takes a lot of them because they leave him open.
Yeah.
But if he has a nice game, then those types of things. Yes, you can beat Sacramento without him, but I don't love the fact that you've dominated them, and they're playing with confidence right now. They're playing with house money, and you don't have one of your key players. It just, for me, it's a real bad recipe that's brewing right here.
All of that is fair. I just... again, it's a lot easier for me, and I don't want to cross a line here because I know for the teams that I live and die with, I don't need all this unrealistic false optimism because that's just trash talk that means nothing. But I really do think that they can match up okay with these next two potential opponents if they win tomorrow night without Zion, but they need Ingram, and I don't know that that's going to be an option. That's the problem.
They've played Sacramento five times. The only time Sacramento was within single digits was when they played them back-to-back games. They played them 2 days apart. The first time they beat them by 36. The second time they beat them by 5. Other than that, they beat them by 10, 33, and 12. They have dominated every game of this series, essentially. It's just crazy.
It's a little scary, but I still think that means that you can beat them without Zion. So we will see. All right. I'm trying to get through an awful day. Y'all do the same.